to TWIL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on May 20th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore in Baltimore, Maryland.
And today we're joined by Leslie Francis. Leslie is the Associate Dean for Faculty Research and Development at the University of Utah College of Law, where she serves both as a Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and a Distinguished Professor in the College of Law. Leslie is, frankly, distinguished. She is a prolific scholar and an deep and original thinker about data protection. Welcome, Leslie.
Thank you very much.
Well, Frank, given the expertise of our guest, I don't think anyone's really going to be too surprised by the topics for today. Where will you take us first?
First, we wanted to go to talk about the uses of big data in healthcare. And I know in some of our past episodes, like with Mark Rothstein, we've discussed a lot about the potential for the blurring of the usual clinical versus research distinction in the use of health data. We've also talked about the learning healthcare system and initiatives there. Well, I wanted to complement those issues in discussing with Leslie some of her work on public health uses of big data. So, Leslie, would you let our listeners know about some of the leading policy concerns about public health uses of big data in healthcare?
Well, first of all, let me just say that big data can be an enormously valuable public health resource if it is used appropriately and protected appropriately. Now, one of the significant privacy side concerns is when data sets get mixed together, mashed up, however you want to call that, so that if the data were separate, you wouldn't be able to identify people. But you end up with more information, even when you're working with originally de-identified data sets, that might enable the re-identification of people. So when multiple sources of data get combined for public health purposes, the privacy risks potentially rise. On the other side, the benefits... Again, if the analytics are sufficiently sophisticated, let me say, the public health benefits are potentially enormous too. And they really range from the possibility of identification of infectious disease outbreaks, identification of distribution potentially of toxic exposures, identification of patterns of behavior that affect health, and the creation of correlations that might not be causal at all, but might still be informative for people trying to figure out what's happening with respect to public health trends.
That is such a great rundown of the promise and the perils of these types of data sets. And I promise our listeners that I will put on the show notes page two items from Paul Ohm that I think are good at adumbrating some of the concerns that you've raised, Leslie. One being his article on re-identification, de-anonymization of supposedly anonymized research. Another being a challenge that he raised to the uses of big data in the context of Google flu trends, called the underwhelming benefits of big data. I was wondering, in terms of the uses of big data in healthcare, have we seen good examples of transitions from mass data collection to knowledge to action based on the knowledge? Or do you think that, in a way that is somewhat reminiscent of the three stages of meaningful use, we're still stuck at the data collection phase now?
I think we're still stuck at the data. Maybe it isn't even the data collection phase. We've got reams of data. Everything from grocery store purchasing patterns. Anytime you use one of those friendly local neighborhood frequent shopper cards, that give you a discount off of something, no doubt like potato chips, that then your healthcare provider might not want to know about, all the way to the wearables that I'm just shocked at how many people I know who now are trotting around with their Fitbits looking at the number of steps they've taken. So we've got tons of data, but we haven't thought through, partly because a lot of the data lies in proprietary silos. So if you look at healthcare records data, for example, where one might hope that there were more in the way of data sharing, you don't get it to the kinds of extent that might be helpful. So I think people are sort of looking at all of this and saying, oh, just think and look at what Google did a couple of years ago. They got it right before the CDC did on a flu outbreak. And then, of course, they didn't later because people thought the whole thing was so interesting that they kept Googling Google flu trends, thereby throwing the whole thing all out of whack. But so there's a kind of excitement about it, but there are also, and there are people using it for commercial purposes now, for example, trying to figure out who are likely to be the most expensive patients, which is not exactly the way I'd like my healthcare system to be learning, but it's certainly learning something. And there are everything from physician quality or hospital or nursing home quality with your GPS location. So if you're looking for a doc, you can figure out where you might want to go. So there are all kinds of uses, but they're sort of scattered and they're often commercially driven. But there's enormous potential out there that could, in fact, help communities figure out how to do a better job of using data to identify what the health problems are in the community and identify what some of the triggers might be to help make them better. So I could just add to that end, actually, the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics has just published a toolkit for communities using data to improve community health. And it's got all sorts of tips about how to adequately protect the privacy and security of the data.
So when I talk about this, or when I think about this, hopefully usually in the right order, I make a couple of distinctions here. First of all, I draw a distinction between big data being used outside of the healthcare system and big data being used inside the healthcare system. With regard to the former, the outside, I've been pretty critical of big data in some of the things I've written, particularly when I see big data essentially recreating data. The use of big data, wherever it comes from, inside the healthcare system. The list I have clearly includes the sort of public health and population health stuff that you're talking about, as well as intramural research, which I'm guessing we'll get to at some point today. But I think the use at the clinical point of care is really interesting. I mean, I think big data has the potential to provide information to a physician as she is writing a script that suggests that this is a patient who would be non-compliant and that therefore can begin an interesting conversation. I think we are already, and you alluded to this somewhat, Leslie, we're already seeing big data being used at a sort of clinical slash operations level. The using data analysis to predict who will be the frequent flyers for readmissions purposes. There are also healthcare entities using big data to identify physicians who are likely to be the causes of HACs. So I think we already have those pieces coming in. And I think you already have to start pulling this area apart and try and sort of produce a typology, because different sort of legal controls that exist now or may exist in the future will apply differently to different pieces of this puzzle.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's entirely correct. And I think within the clinical system, you mentioned various kinds of quality improvement initiatives. You also mentioned efforts to identify which physicians or other providers might be problem hotspots. You also, what you didn't mention was increasingly, and again, there's much that's untapped here, the ability to use better evidence to consider what sorts of care might be most beneficial to this patient. Now, you mentioned the possibility that if, for example, the physician had at her fingertips this patient's grocery store purchase list, which is certainly a possibility, if it is something that could be done, let's put it that way. I'm not at all suggesting that it actually is being done, but it's something that could be done. You might very well know that this is a patient who, although she says she has never had a drop of alcohol, is buying wine regularly at the supermarket. So the suggestion of noncompliance is how we might very well be able to predict, given physiological information, given tumor type information, whether this is a patient who would be more likely to benefit from a certain kind of intervention. And you didn't also mention the patient just might not want her doctor to know everything. And much as we think it might be prudential for the patient to want her doctor to know everything, we also, I think, need to respect the patient's own autonomous ability to make even what for some might seem irrational choices and create her own information silos if she so chooses. That's the privacy side.
That is a really good explanation of the costs and benefits, I think, Leslie, and I bracket that term costs and benefits because I realize that, especially from one coming from a philosophical perspective, the incommensurable nature of the values and desiderata at stake here is very important. And on a personal note, I could just note that I recently, the University of Maryland system has imposed a wellness program on everyone, and the health risk assessment includes over 80 questions, many of them deeply personal, about do you feel happy usually? Do you feel close to your partner? Do you feel closer than ever to your partner? You know, just a huge list of questions that they want you to answer and to share with your primary care physician. I also was asked to comment by Natasha Singer last year on a hospital system's integration of credit scores and credit information into to alert the hospital system to who might be non-compliant and who is not. And we all know that there's a FICO medication compliance score out there, which is into these things as well. So I think these are, we're just at the cutting edge, and your work is at the cutting edge, and Nick's as well, of the issues here. Now, just to transition to our next topic, we want to search for solutions here, and I think some of the more creative approaches to fair information practices and data subjects' autonomy vis-a-vis data controllers are coming out of Europe. And I was wondering, Leslie, if you could discuss with us some of the initiatives, new ideas, new modes of regulation that you think are most relevant here coming out of Europe presently.
Yeah, before I actually get to Europe, I want to call your attention to the fact that there was a special issue of the Journal of Social Philosophy last fall on technology and new challenges for privacy, in which I have a co-authored paper on public health uses of data and fair information practice principles. And my co-author and I emphasize the importance of having full but appropriately protected uses of data. And two fair information practice principles I think are critical here. One of them is transparency. And that means not only a data controller, that's the European term, making public what data they're collecting and what they're doing with the data, but a data controller making very clear when they initially collect data what the possibilities are. Typically, if you order something over the internet in Europe, for example, the kinds of check boxes that you receive are very different from the ones you would receive if you ordered it in the U.S. So transparency to the individual whose data it is, public transparency, and transparency about what is learned from the use of the data. One of my great beefs about clinical trials, actually going back to the clinical in the U.S., is that people who are enrolled in clinical trials often never know what came of them. So fair information practice principles, you know, it's very easy when you sign up for a clinical trial to give them your email address and check the box, I would like to, do you want to get our newsletter? Yes or no? Give us your email address if you do. So transparency from the beginning to the public and on through the data collection and use. Another fair information practice principle that I think is critical that needs to be adhered to much more carefully than I think it actually is purpose specification. And there need to be justifications when data that are originally collected for one kind of purpose get used for another. You find much more interesting than that in Europe. Something that I think is not really thought about, and this is the point of my co-author and my paper in the Journal of Social Philosophy, is that we don't think a lot about the justice issues involved in data use. But if people whose data are critical in understanding, say, public health, never get any benefits out of that understanding, we have a social justice problem. And that's never really been on the table about fair information practice principles, but I think it should be. So that's just a little bit more about some of what I think could guide data use in the U.S. Now to Europe. Europe has, it recognizes the right to private life and to the protection of personal relationships in the Europe it has 546, which is the Data Protection Directive. Directive 9546 was actually enacted in 1995. So if you think of what wasn't around in 1995, all kinds of Web 2.0, many sorts of uses of data were simply not, they were either not even envisioned or they were some gleam in someone's eye in 1995. So about 5 or 6 years ago now, Europe undertook significant revision of Directive 9546. And the proposed new, what will actually be a regulation rather than a directive, so it will impose more uniform standards even than the directive does across the European community, is in the final approval stage processes right now in the European Union. Europe wanted to have strong privacy protection so that the free movement of data within the European Union would be a reality. That's why they have the minimum significant privacy protection standards, even as they are in Directive 9546. Now, so that's just a little, it's an overarching directive. It imposes the same kinds of rules on all sorts of data, whether it's your order online or your medical record. And so you can trust that if your data gets transferred from your medical record plate, and all of that will continue in the proposed change. The big recent developments are what people call the right to be forgotten, or the right of delisting, or the right of erasure.
Let's back up just a little bit, because okay. the distinction that you you draw between the existing European law and the likely future law, the distinction between a directive and a regulation is somewhat important in this context. The directive, although I agree with you, was passed at a time when so many of our current problems were not even imagined, even by science fiction writers. The directive was nevertheless quite far thinking, I think. I mean, its ideas of data minimization, respect for context, and so on are things that we only wish we had in place in this country, and I think were pieces that I pulled out in particular to praise in the administration's recent draft Consumer Bill of Rights, privacy rights. Where the directive had some flaws was because it relies on all of the member states to play along and do the right thing and really create legislation that really is in accord with the directive, which is the directive to the member states. And the other thing that I guess is somewhat flawed is that in the current law is that the each member state has a separate data agency, data protection agency. And from the perspective of business, the good news is bad businesses can practice regulatory arbitrage. The bad news is that good businesses are faced with multiple regulators instead of a single regulator. And so there are some sort of process pieces that clearly are being fixed in the regulation. But what's kind of interesting as the regulation started working its way through the various legislative pieces in Europe was this, as you say, this right to be forgotten, this right of erasure. And this looked really quite controversial, only for the European Court of Justice applying the old law to suddenly reach deep down into their judicial creativity bin and pull out something like erasure or the right to be forgotten under the existing law. So maybe that's your lead-in, Leslie, to this fascinating new way of protecting data, or essentially getting rid of it.
Well, actually, what the Gonzalez case did was require under European privacy law what's called delisting under certain cases. So here's the case. A gentleman in Spain had property sold in a forced sale to satisfy some bad public debts. The notice of public sale was published in a newspaper of record, La Valencia, and was an entirely legal publication. At the time, in fact, when condemned property is being sold to satisfy debts, you want people to know about the sale so that they come and the property fetches a good price. So that was what happened about 15 years ago. Now, the archives of the newspaper are digitized, and if you search the gentleman's name, one thing that would come up very regularly and under a Google search was this newspaper report of the forced sale. He had long since moved beyond, he thought, those troubled times, and it wasn't pleasant to have that be the link. So he sued the newspaper requesting erasure from the public from the digitized archive, and Google requesting that the search engine break the link so that when you search for his name, the link to the story no longer showed up. In the Spanish court, the suit against the newspaper was not granted. The idea was that this was a lawfully published record. So when the case got to the European Court of Justice, it was only about the search engine links. So if you had gone, if you went today to the newspaper archives and searched for the name of the property, the address of the property, and a forced sale, you'd still get it. And you'd get Mr. Gonzalez's name attached to it. You just won't get it when you search for Gonzalez. So what the European Court of Justice concluded was that he was not a public figure. The information had long since outlived its usefulness, and it was sensitive and damaging to him. And so under 9546, the delisting needed to occur. So it's actually not a full erasure. It's delisting that the ECJ imposed. The proposed new regulation, which is in the final stages, would actually grant, in appropriate circumstances, the right to request erasure. And that's what's got some people from the science and the research community seriously concerned, although there is an exception for historical, statistical, and scientific information. But once the data are being used for scientific purposes, if under appropriate protections, you're not going to be able to request erasure. But if you request erasure before it gets used in that way, there is a potential that there will be more limited available data in the European Union. And that's the subject of some significant concern. Now, you should know that there have been hundreds of thousands of requests for delisting to search engines such as Google and to newspapers. And some of the European newspapers actually publish lists on their websites of links that have been broken. So that's what's going on here.
That is such a great rundown of a number of complex issues in Europe. And I just wanted to make two quick points, one being that the right to be forgotten, as vindicated in the Costeja case, I believe is going to have a big impact in the U.S. if we have situations where there are breaches of medical data that are republished again and again online, which search engines are not doing a good job of delinking from or not indexing, because it is very easy to imagine that type of republication happening. And even though the original breacher can't publish what they've breached under Bartnicki versus Vopper, if there's a plausible public interest justification in it, then there's a First Amendment argument with the republisher. So that's going to be a really tough one. Yep. The other side, too, in terms of the right of erasure, it does recall for me I think it was a bit of a debate between Mark Rothstein and Barbara Evans about consent bias and the degree to which, say, people requesting erasure or to be kept out of these types of databases would lead to consent bias. And so that will be a very, very hot issue. I agree.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some questions about consent bias in Europe if this goes forward. I should also say that while on the one hand, Europe has great advantages of having a minimum privacy floor for just about any kind of data, not law enforcement or national security, but just about everything else. We have a very patchworky sectoral set of rules. There are different rules for your video records than there are for your driver's licenses, than there are for your health records, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, that sectoral structure, while it is very confusing to people, it does give some possibility for thinking about whether delisting might be appropriate in some contexts, but not in others. So, for example, if we need complete data sets for certain kinds of public health or clinical health purposes, we might want to say different things about delisting than we do about the kind of case that you just brought up. One of the things that I find most troubling in the U.S. is that expunged criminal records and exonerations continue to show up for exactly the same reason. They got copied once, and they're in the credit check or the employment check or the housing check, and what was supposed to have actually been erased keeps on haunting people in very problematic ways. So we probably need to think more, and we have the potential to think in very interesting ways sectorally about erasure or delisting possibilities that we're just not doing at all. And some of the reason, of course, is free speech, as you mentioned.
So let's push that a little bit further, Leslie, taking some of those sort of principles from FIPS and also from the EU, data minimization, delisting, context, and so on. And let's push them in a little further in the healthcare sphere. Is there positive potential for the use of these kinds of restrictions on data collection or data retention within the healthcare system? Or is there just a blanket response, no, because we are treating you and that's a long-term prospect, and because we're doing responsible healthcare research, there should be no limitations placed on data that comes into the traditional healthcare system?
Well, so one of the things to just bear in mind is that some of the very controversial cases that have led to the destruction of newborn screening, blood spots, or the Havasupai case that I'm assuming your listeners are familiar with, of the Native American data that was originally collected for diabetes research and then was repurposed for mental health research and for ancestry research. And the newborn blood spots were not entirely used for public health purposes either. So some of the most controversial cases have been taking data that was originally collected for health reasons and then employing it outside of the healthcare arena for something entirely different. So my actual view is that we get treated now out of shared funds. So if you get some kind of healthcare treatment, you're not paying the full costs of it, whatever insurance scheme you're part of. And it seems to me that an entirely reasonable aspect of our being part of a shared system is the use of data in, to go circle way back to the beginning, for an appropriately improving and learning healthcare system. So I'm not arguing for an opt-out on the health side. I'm arguing for people being given information about what's being done and for people being told about what's being learned, for distinctions between health improvement and public health protection and various kinds of commercial uses that benefit pharmaceutical companies or whatever happens to be the interest of a particular researcher. That's where the purpose specification, I think, really kicks in. And I think you understand that if you're getting healthcare treatment, one of the things that health information can do is it can improve the treatment you get and your friends get and your neighbors get the next time, and that we should view ourselves as being part of that kind of cooperative scheme. So I wasn't arguing for erasure there, but I think I would argue for an opt-out when data are repurposed for a non-healthcare reason.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A special thank you to Leslie Francis. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We post our show notes at twill.com. That's TWIHL.com. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
I am at Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.